finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
You don't normally wake up one day and decide to kill your wife with protein shakes. At least most people wouldn't. I would think if you're going to decide to do that, you'd plan it. Maybe test it, I don't know. You Google how to get away with it. And if you're James Craig, maybe allegedly you do all that while juggling mistresses, maxed out credit cards, and a public image as a doting father of 6. Welcome to the trial that's taken suburban horror to a whole new level. Angela Craig is dead. She died slow, confused, and terrified while the man she trusted sat by her hospital bed, allegedly, pretending to be concerned. The prosecutors are laying out in this Colorado courtroom isn't just a murder case, it's a story of systematic deception, chilling patience, and a digital breadcrumb trail that looks less like a mystery and more like a blueprint for homicide. And here's the kicker. There's no security footage of the moment he allegedly poisoned her, no smoking gun, no direct eyewitness, just a tightrope of circumstantial evidence. And a prosecution team walking it like they built the wire themselves. This is where the law gets clinical and psychological. The state's case is loaded with metadata, motive, and calculated restraint. It's not just what James Craig did, it's how methodically he didn't leave anything behind except the data. So how do you prosecute a murder that's invisible in real time but screaming through text messages, Amazon orders, and prison residue? That's where today's guest comes in. Eric Faddis is a former prosecutor who's been watching this case from inside the courtroom. He's not here to play hypotheticals. He's here to tell us what actually is happening in that room, what's working, what's not, and what the jury is really up against. Because when you peel back the sensational headlines and TikTok commentary, we're left with a number of things. A murder case that hinges on trust, silence, and one simple question. Does the evidence feel like murder? Or does it prove it? So, Eric, you've sat through a lot of this trial. What was the most damning thing the jury has heard so far, and why do you think it landed the way it did?
Well, yesterday, there was a bombshell dropped while I was in the courtroom. They had an inmate on the stand. He was an inmate in the same facility as James Craig. And James Craig allegedly asked him to do a number of things. One is kill the lead detective. Two is essentially recruit folks who would say they were friends of Angela Craig and that she was suicidal at the time. And in fact, there was a letter that was introduced into evidence purportedly written by James Craig that details all of these incriminating aspects of the case. And James Craig, after it was read, was pretty reserved and seemed rather disheartened.
Oh, his ego, his kind of verboseness went down a little bit, are you saying? Interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's been rather animated in the courtroom and involved and kind of has a confident demeanor. Mm-hmm. But they read that letter in painstaking detail to the jury. And after that, he was kind of slouching in his chair and not so animated.
All right. Obviously, there's no cameras in the courtroom. There's no audio in the courtroom. Give me your best description of what that letter said.
Yeah, so it was written very eloquently. There were words like suppositional and ill-fated and things like that. secrets you might commonly associate with, you know, the average inmate letter that comes out of a jail. So they're saying that connects it to James Craig in detailed roles that he wanted folks to play. There were at least four roles, and those included people who would say they were friends of Angela Craig. And there were details like, hey, you went to Angela Craig's meeting. She had like hobbies and meetings that she would go to. You met her there and you know, realized she was suicidal and that kind of thing. There were also requests to fabricate different evidence, to tamper with evidence, and ultimately to kill the lead investigator, Bobby Olson.
This is like such an extreme. I mean, this takes this case, as quite often happens, the worst, not the worst things, but the incrimination gets even more incriminating after the fact. Had he not done all of these things, he might have a much, you know, stronger case or less things to go on that make him look so damn guilty. And now that there's the letter, that takes it from just hearsay. It takes it from just some inmate saying, I'll tell you whatever you want to hear. So he gets some sort of leniency or kickback to a new level of incrimination. It almost makes me wonder, did he have ChatGPT write it? The way that it was that eloquent, did that run through your mind at all? Like, because it is written so well, was it handwritten, I'm going to guess?
Was handwritten.
Okay.
The handwriting seemed consistent with other writings James Craig had done. However, my understanding is the prosecution didn't have a handwriting expert look at it. And so I think the defense is going to try to challenge it on that angle, but it's going to be tough.
Why not have? Okay. This is another one of those where it's like, okay, you got it. The one thing you could do to screw this up or give reasonable doubt over here is not have a handwriting expert look at it. Why not?
It doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, these prosecutors, I know them very well, Ryan Brackley and Mike Morrow, they are usually meticulous and methodical, and they have been throughout the trial. This seemed to be an oversight of sorts. It would have been relatively easy to enlist a handwriting expert. The state does it all the time. They have the resources to do it. And so this was kind of a loose end that has not been tied up yet.
I mean, does budgetary restraints come into that? Does discovery timelines play into that at all? Obviously these things happened after the crime. They just kind of added to the criminality of the whole damn thing. Is that a factor in something like that? Or is it just kind of like, look, jury, here's his handwriting, here's that handwriting. Do you really need this person over here to tell you that this is this handwriting?
Yeah, Toby, I'm actually, I was formerly a prosecutor in the same office that's prosecuting James Craig now. And for homicide cases, especially high-profile ones, they really spared no expense. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it was a resource issue. You know, they have so many aspects of this case that are compelling, that are incriminating. And I think they probably just determined, hey, I think we've got enough here. Let's move forward and we'll deal with whatever challenge the defense brings.
There's been a lot of Google searches in this as well, how to make murder look like a heart attack, undetectable poisons. Again, he didn't search for what would blend well with arsenic, which might have made a little better. But I'm imagining those Google searches also have not played well in court. How has the jury been reacting to those? And also, how has he been reacting to those as these little revelations get sprinkled throughout the trial?
You know, the jury, especially at these dramatic moments during the Google searches, during the letters, they were on the edge of their seat and they're taking notes. They're looking at the monitors when the letter is published to the jury. They are very engaged. And in fact, after that letter, there was a bench conference and the jurors all kind of like had a like, whoa, that was clearly a big deal in this trial. James Craig throughout, like I said, has been rather confident. And in fact, when some of this evidence comes out, he's shaking his head. No, you can see him. Some people say that's sort of trying to telegraph some kind of signal to the jury that, hey, this isn't legitimate or whatever. But like I mentioned, after this letter was read and they went through, I think it's 9 pages or so, they went through the highlights over a course of about 45 minutes. And James Craig was sort of slouching in his seat. He was not animated. He was not engaging with his attorneys. He seemed a bit forlorn at that point.
That's interesting, because if at the beginning he's trying to do this persona of, oh, wrongfully Hughes, this is, what are they making up over here? You would think that would be consistent throughout, no matter what's being brought up, if it's all a bunch of BS and the state's out to get the dentist for whatever reason, because, you know, states just like to target dentists for some reason. I mean, it's they're anti-dentites. They are. It's going after the dental community. It's one of those things where inconsistent behavior then in that arc where, okay, you're kind of like over here. Now that's really showing something. How do you think do you think the jury is reading the tea leaves on this?
I think the jury is very closely monitoring James Craig's demeanor, how he's presenting in court, how he's reacting to these pieces of evidence, because he's been doing it the whole time and he does it in a noticeable way. So surely the jury observed that. And, you know, even in the letter itself, James Craig says a few weird things. He says that the state is after him, doing evil tactics against him, so he has to resort to the same or something to that effect. Additionally, he alleges in the letter that the office manager, Romero, actually did the Google searches that were highly incriminating to sort of frame him for some kind of unarticulated reason.
Do you think this man is having a mental health crisis at the end of the day? Because if we're talking like the state's after me for this or that, maybe they are. I mean, but maybe for a real valid reason. But if it sounds more like, you know, paranoid delusions and killing his wife, or he didn't kill his wife. I mean, that's what I'm wondering. Are we dealing with something here beyond just, I'm trying to cover this murder up because I wanted to go have, you know, endless affairs and I didn't want my money to be cut in half? I'm wondering if there is a mental health component to this that we're not seeing, because it does kind of feel like this guy may be a little bit not playing with a full deck, or not playing with reality on reality's terms.
You know, that's the thing. He certainly seems detached from reality in multiple pieces of evidence and throughout multiple stages of the case. He sort of has this overblown, delusional confidence, like he can't be touched. He's writing these letters from jail, knowing that jail letters are subject to review by jail authorities. And so it seems like for a while he was just disconnected to the gravity of what was going on, and sort of had this paranoid air about him. You know, probably doesn't rise to the level of any kind of defense, and then it's sort of undercut by how articulate he is in these letters and in some other communications. So I don't think it's going to help him much, but does he have a firm grasp on reality? No.
I mean, yeah, it feels, and obviously I can't diagnose, but it feels like a narcissistic personality disorder or borderline or something along those lines, where that grandioseness is there, but it's not conclusive to reality. It's not there where it makes any sort of sense. What do you do with a case like this, where the villain, if proven guilty, wasn't sloppy, wasn't impulsive, wasn't even particularly theatrical, just cold, patient, methodical, allegedly? That's what makes the trial so haunting. There's no explosion, no freakout, no moment where things get out of hand. The horror here is in the precision. And if the jury believes it, in the fact that James Craig might have played the long game to become a widower without a single fingerprint on the scene, the prosecution's argument is meticulous, maybe even elegant in a grim kind of way. It's built on timestamps, chemistry, text threads, and the weird consistency of a man who allegedly plotted murder like it was a clinical procedure. And yet it's still circumstantial. That's what makes this such a legal balancing act, because in a case with no eyewitnesses, no direct confession, and no single gotcha moment, the question becomes, is the sum of all of the parts enough? And the defense? They've hinted at suicide, floated doubt. They're poking at the chain of evidence and a medical mystery of all of it. But what they haven't done, at least not yet, is offer a theory that holds water emotionally. Because Angela's daughters didn't look like kids mourning a parent who chose to die. They look like daughters betrayed. Their testimony didn't just counter the suicide theory, it torched it. So where does this leave us? It leaves us in a courtroom where the evidence doesn't yell, but it doesn't need to. It drips. It accumulates. It looks back on itself until one version of the story just stops making sense. But there are still cracks. This isn't a slam dunk. And if you're in the jury box, maybe you're wondering, why would someone smart enough to order cyanide in someone else's name be dumb enough to do it from a Gmail address tied to his real identity? Why keep the deepfake letter? Why risk jailhouse letters if the story was solid? Or maybe you're thinking this guy's not a criminal mastermind. He's just arrogant enough to think he could get away with it. We're going to continue to dive into that exact question in our next conversation with Eric. So be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss it here on our podcast feed. Motive, double lives, the web of affairs, money trouble, sugar babies, and alleged plots written in ballpoint pen from jail. Because if this was about how, our next conversation is about the why. Again, press subscribe. Let us know in the comment section what your thoughts are on the case thus far. Be sure to search us on YouTube. Just search Hidden Killers, the Tony Bruschi, to find us there or wherever you're getting podcasts so you can listen to us. Vice versa, both places. It's great to have you everywhere we are. We do greatly appreciate that. Let me know in the comments what your thoughts are. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.